Chapter 8. After an hour, Jack decided they had to find a place to set up camp for the night, as the sun was hanging low in the sky. Despite their bruised and aching bodies, they rose to their feet and made their way into the forest, dragging their packs behind them. A sparse forest bordered the edge of the mountain. Jack remembered from his observations at the top of the cliff that the forest would soon become a more dense jungle. He only hoped they would find a suitable place to camp before they reached that point. The trees were somehow different here. They weren't the tall, pointed towers he had seen reaching for the sky on the other side of the hills. These trees tended to spread out horizontally, their branches twisting, turning, and intermingling through those of their neighbors. The ground here was soft and was covered with short, thick, blue, grass-like vegetation that Will referred to as moss. The air was moist and heavy as well, as the fine mist from the many waterfalls along the south end of the valley wafted across the treetops, eventually finding its way to the ground below. While they made their way toward the sound of the water, Will explained that the valley must have been cut right through the sides of the mountains by the river, over many millennia, possibly taking advantage of an area of weak, unsteady rock, allowing it to carve out such a large area. The river itself ran along the southeast wall of the mountain, turning due west and traversing the jungle until it turned north again to run along the mountain wall on the western side of the valley. They came down the mountainside a few kilometers north of the river's western turn. Once they reached the far side, they would have to figure out a way to cross it before they could begin their ascent of what they hoped would be the last obstacle between them and the western coastline. The terrain here was uneven, with strange rocks jutting up out of the ground that were nearly big enough to be called mountains themselves. Their course soon became more convoluted, and Jack was beginning to suspect there was no water nearby, and that the sounds he thought he was hearing were auditory hallucinations. As they rounded yet another large rocky outcropping, Jack felt a warm mist fall upon his face and head. The sound he had been hearing became louder, the tree line broke, and they found themselves standing in front of a beautiful pond at the base of an elegant waterfall. The pond was an oval shape, about 40 meters long and 30 meters wide, flowing into a small stream at one end. There was a waterfall some 10 meters from a plateau of rock at the far end.
"Would you look at that?" Will exclaimed.
"Pretty, isn't it?"
"No, I mean those rocks," Will corrected. "That plateau, I don't think that it's really a plateau. I think that we're probably in a really big sinkhole or something."
"What?"
"I wasn't sure before, but all those rocky crags jutting up, I think this whole area was once part of a volcanic flat."
"What's that?"
"It's an area of unstable volcanic activity, kind of like a huge underground lava flow that connects one volcano to another."
"You mean those twin peaks back there?" Jack asked, referring to the two mountains that bordered the cliff they had just come down.
"Probably. Occasionally the flow gets obstructed along the way, and pressure builds up within the channel. Eventually it has to be let off, usually by forming underground pools. Hence the pushed-up crags of rock we keep seeing."
"Do you mean we're going to have to climb back out of here?" Jack said in disbelief.
"Maybe. I don't know. That level up there might just be the result of a shelf that was pushed up higher than the land around it when one of those underground pools formed. It's just a guess, Jack. I mean, we don't have much information about the geology of this planet."
Will stepped up to the pond, squatting down and dipping his hand in the water.
"It's very warm." He looked around. "Something underground must be heating the water."
"Like one of those lava pockets?"
"Possibly."
Will pulled the water test kit out of his backpack and set it down next to the water. With a plastic cup, he scooped up some of the pond water and set it next to the kit. Pulling the probe out of the kit, he inserted it into the cup of water and turned the analyzer on. A few seconds later, data started scrolling down the analyzer's small display screen.
"How is it?" Jack asked.
"Not bad," Will answered as he watched the data. "A little high in minerals, which is to be expected, especially if there's a magma pressure vent under the water." Is it safe?
As it is, yes. It probably won't taste very good, but it won't hurt you.
I don't want to taste it, Jack announced, as he began to take off his clothes.
What are you doing?
Will asked, curiously.
I'm going to take a well-deserved bath, my friend.
But, Jack, we don't have any idea what's in there.
I don't care, Jack declared. I just want to get rid of this layer of filth that's been forming for days.
Remember that thing in the river?
Will pointed out, reminding Jack of the long, snake-like organism that brushed past his leg in the water.
Look, I got 10 days of funk growing on me right now, Jack explained, as he stripped the last of his clothing off, leaving it in a pile next to his pack. I smell so bad that I can't even stand being in my tent with myself at night.
Jack pulled a bottle of biodegradable soap out of his pack.
No offense, Will, but you could use a little scrubbing down yourself, he advised, as he stepped carefully into the water. Oh, you're right. It is warm.
Jack walked out further, one cautious step at a time, until he was up to his ribs. Will watched in fascination as Jack squatted down, submerging himself up to his neck in the warm water.
How is it?
It's wonderful, Jack assured him.
Jack ducked his head under the water briefly, wetting his face and hair.
Come on in, Will!
Reluctantly, Will began to remove his clothing, being a bit tidier than Jack. Jack poured some soap over his head and began scrubbing down his hair. Within minutes, he had worked up a good lather of greenish-brown bubbles. He stood up again, spreading the lather down over his shoulders, arms, and torso. Finally stripped down to his bare skin, Will waded cautiously into the warm water. The pond floor was hard, like rock, and felt somewhat porous under his bare feet. Will wondered if it was hardened lava flow. If so, then his theory about how the water was heated might prove correct. Jack handed the bottle of soap to Will.
Not bad, huh?
He asked, as he squatted down again, ducking his head underwater to rinse off the lather. Will poured some soap over his head as well, working it into his hair and down over his body. Meanwhile, Jack was wading back to shore to get his clothes.
Might as well wash these while we're here,
he decided, as he picked up both his and Will's clothes and brought them back out into the water. They spent 20 minutes standing naked, waist deep in the warm pond, as they rinsed out their clothing. After that, they took the clothing back to shore and spread it out on tree branches to allow it to dry, going back into the water to finish cleaning themselves. Satisfied that he was clean, Jack began to venture farther out into the pond, curiously searching the bottom through crystal waters.
Lose something, Jack?
Have you looked at the bottom? There are little bubbles coming out.
Will moved closer to take a look for himself.
It's probably seeping up through the porous rock. There's got to be a lot of pressure down there to force the hot air up through the rock like that.
Could it blow?
Probably not. The constant venting probably keeps the pressure from getting too high.
Will observed the floor for himself.
Did you notice if the bubbles are coming out from all over the place, or are they along a specific line?
I don't know, Jack admitted,
as he continued looking. For several minutes, they searched the bottom of the pond, trying to determine a pattern in the bubbles. Jack wasn't entirely sure why they were doing this, but it was sort of fun. Then Jack heard a strange sound, a kind of a snort or a grunt. He looked up, then to his left and right, but saw nothing. Then he heard it again. He spun around to look behind him. On the shore, digging through their packs, were several furry brown creatures, each about 1 meter tall.
Oh, shit!
Jack began splashing through the water, heading back toward the shore as quickly as possible, yelling at the top of his lungs,
Hey, get out of there! Go on, get lost! Beat it!
Will chased after him. But as they approached the shore, one of the creatures turned to face them, rearing up onto its hind legs and growling ferociously at them. It appeared quite large and threatening, as it bared its considerable teeth at them. Jack stopped suddenly.
Whoa, wait a minute!
The creature continued its deafening roar, causing Jack to retreat a few steps, shrinking back down into the water, as if he were trying to hide. Will followed suit, also not wanting to provoke the animal any further. What are they doing?
They're eating our food, Jack realized.
What do we do now?
What can we do? Our weapons are next to the packs, and we're standing out here naked. All we can do is wait, and hope they get full before all our food is gone.
Dinner that night had been jovial. A good day's work had been done, and with the last of the huts being built, their base camp was completed. Even Frank had joined in with renewed interest, much to everyone's surprise. Starting tomorrow, the work of surveying the entire valley could finally begin. All the science equipment was up and functioning, thanks to Frank's enthusiastic efforts throughout the day. Even Adia seemed to overcome her difficulties in dealing with the great outdoors, although more often than not, she ended up working in a secluded corner somewhere. As they finished their meal, Lynn went over the itinerary for the next day. Frank, Mac, Tony, and she would begin surveying the valley with the aerial reconnaissance drone to develop a detailed map of the area. Laura and Adia would begin the task of specimen collection, setting out various traps to collect samples of insect and animal life for biological and genetic analysis. Sarah would continue working on her agricultural experiments and cultivation of their food crops, while Maria would spend her day in the med lab, comparing the latest crew workups with their post-arrival conditions, looking for any potentially harmful anomalies. All in all, things seemed to be going pretty well, and Lynn was beginning to feel optimistic once more. After the briefing, the crew dispersed, each to their usual off-duty pursuits. Frank retired to the flight deck for another evening of attempting to find some way to repair the radar set. As much as it bothered Lynn to see Frank continuing his efforts, as he had pointed out, it was his time, and he could do with it as he saw fit, as long as it didn't interfere with their mission. It was an unspoken agreement they had forged, and for now, it would have to suffice. After his usual evening workout, Tony went outside for a breath of fresh air. As he stood at the front of the ship, staring at the evening sky, a noise from the starboard side of the ship caught his attention. Curious, he circled around the outside of the cargo pods, arranged along the starboard side, half expecting to find the intruder that had visited the camp a few weeks ago during their overnight absence. Instead, he found Adia.
"Oh, it's you," he said,
relieved that there was no intruder.
"What are you doing out here?"
"Nothing," she answered meekly.
"Nothing?
I'm just stargazing."
"Oh."
Tony walked over and sat down on the ground next to her.
"You're the last person I'd expect to be out here, sitting all alone in the darkness."
"Yes, I know. Somehow, it doesn't seem quite as intimidating at night. I'm not sure if it's the reduced visibility or the beauty of the night sky. It just doesn't seem as vast."
"Yeah, I can see what you mean," he agreed,
as he leaned back against the cargo pod, his gaze drifting up to the starry sky.
"It is a beautiful sky."
"The stars seem different from down here, not like when you look at them from space."
"It's the atmosphere. It filters out a lot of the weaker, more distant stars and distorts the others. That's what causes the twinkling."
Tony rolled his eyes.
"Of course, you already know that," he said, remembering that Adia held several science degrees.
"Yes, but I wasn't speaking scientifically."
She watched his face. He was peaceful, almost boyishly innocent, as he gazed upward in awe. Here, away from Mac and the others, he was revealing his more sensitive side. It was not a surprise to her, as she had seen glimpses of it in the past.
"In space, it's more of a void, a nothingness," he explained. "You know that in millions of those star systems, there could be beings just like us, going about their day-to-day lives, living and dying, laughing and crying. But because they're so far away, it doesn't seem to mean much. On the Daedalus, we were just cargo, equipment, really, going about our tasks, ensuring our own survival. There were no hopes, no dreams, except for the one that everyone shared, reaching our new home."
Tony let out a sigh. We just went about our assigned duties, day in and day out. But here, the sky is full of hope. Here we are surrounded by infinite possibilities, and not possibilities for our descendants, but for us, right here, right now. That's what the sky means to me.
That's a very nice way of looking at it, Tony.
Tony turned to look at her. He couldn't remember ever hearing her actually say his name before now. She was a beautiful young woman, her delicate face framed by her long black hair. So quiet and shy, yet filled with strength, that he was sure they had yet to see.
Thank you.
She gazed into his eyes. Normally, by now, she would have become embarrassed and turned away, finding some excuse to retreat. But tonight was different. There was a connection she had never felt before, even though she had hoped to feel it on several occasions in the past.
What does the sky mean to you?
Adia? He asked softly, as he leaned a little closer to her.
Nothing,
she lied, looking down at her hands.
I find that hard to believe. You'll think I'm silly.
I doubt that.
Well,
she stalled, trying to muster up the courage.
To me, it means that everything my ancestors gave up, everything they sacrificed along the way, was worth it.
That's a beautiful sentiment, Tony assured her kindly. She looked him in the eyes again. They were even closer to her than before. Tony moved his head in closer, sure that the moment was right, watching to see if she would allow him to kiss her, or if she would withdraw in fear. Scared to death, her hands trembling in her lap, Adia closed her eyes and tilted her head to accept his kiss. Now he was sure it was time, and Tony closed his eyes and moved his head closer still until their lips touched. Just a brief brushing of lips, followed by another, and another.
"Tony, this is Lynn,"
his compset squawked. Tony sat bolt upright, feeling like his parents had just walked in and caught him in the act. Adia also withdrew, pretending as if nothing had happened.
Yes?
Tony announced, as he pulled the mic down to his mouth. "Go ahead, Lynn."
"Have you seen Adia?"
"Yes, we're outside, starboard side."
"Good. Come back in. It's nearly time to button up for the night."
"Copy that. We'll be right in," he promised, as he scrambled to his feet.
He reached out his hand, offering to help Adia to her feet.
"Thank you,"
she replied, as she took his hand and pulled herself up.
"My pleasure."
As the sun went down, the creatures finally grew tired of the food in the packs and left. As soon as they were gone, Jack waded cautiously out of the pond, immediately going for his weapon. Will watched from the pond, choosing to wait at a safe distance while Jack checked things out. It was odd to see Jack tiptoe around the shore in the twilight, naked, carrying his rifle, in search of any remaining animals that might pose a threat. Once Jack was satisfied that the intruders had left, Will felt comfortable exiting the water.
"I can't believe this," Jack swore, as he pulled on his pants.
He didn't waste time with his shirt, eager to investigate the damage. Will went for his clothing, getting completely dressed as quickly as possible.
"How bad is it?"
he asked, as Jack rummaged through their packs.
"Oh, for crying out loud, they ate just about everything!"
Jack continued to frantically search through what was left.
"I've got maybe 3 energy bars, and that's it."
"Well, I've got a bag of dried fruit."
Will was trying to sound encouraging, but failed.
"Oh, and they didn't eat this bag of dehydrated hash."
"Of course not. That stuff is nasty."
Jack sat down, dejected.
"What do we do now?"
"I guess we're going to have to live off the land."
"We have no idea what is edible and what isn't. Maybe we should go back."
"Either way, we're still going to have to live off the land. And I don't know about you, but I sure don't want to climb up that cliff we just fell off of."
Will thought about their situation for a moment, trying to be helpful.
Well, I suppose we could test whatever food sources we might find. We could at least determine their immediate toxicity. But there's really no way to determine their long-term effects in the field.
Well, we know the long-term effects of starvation, that's for sure.
Good point, Will admitted.
Well, this sucks, Jack decided.
Will was astonished to hear Jack admit the reality of their situation. He'd always been so optimistic before. But he was right. It did suck. Here they were, stranded on an alien planet, of which they knew frighteningly little about, at least a week or two from the safety of the LRV, nearly a light-year from their mothership, and over 11 light-years from Earth. And now they had no safe source of nourishment.
Well, let's pitch camp here for a few days, Jack said. We can look for food first thing in the morning. Hopefully, after one or two days of foraging, we can gather enough to move on.
Jack pulled his tent out of his pack.
Looks like you're going to have to put your scientist cap on tomorrow, Will.
It would now be up to Will to determine what they could and could not eat, and the consequences of an incorrect decision could be dire. The thought of that much responsibility made Will a little nervous, but at least that decision would be resting in his hands for once, and not in the hands of others. That, in itself, was something to which he was unaccustomed. Tony was having a difficult time sleeping, in light of what had transpired only an hour ago. It was not his first kiss, but it had felt that way. So many thoughts were running through his mind, the foremost of which was whether he had done the right thing. Was it just one of those situational things, like he had seen in so many of the old Earth movies that Laura and Maria liked to watch? Or was this the start of something real? The Conception Council had not paired up him or Adia with anyone before departure, since the mission was considered so risky. He knew he was getting ahead of himself, but the thought was pleasing. He wanted to tell someone about their kiss, but he couldn't tell Mac, that was certain. Mac would only cause problems with his snickers and uncouth remarks. And he definitely couldn't tell Laura. She was already trying to match them up with one another. So he continued to toss and turn in his berth, wondering what the future might hold, and what Adia was thinking now. Across the hall, Adia was drifting off faster than usual. She had never felt so content in her life, at least not that she could remember. It was amazing to her how one kiss, so small in act, could be so eventful to her. She had grown up in a world where you took the mate that the council assigned to you. Until now, she had fully expected to acquiesce to the council's decision, just like everyone else. But suddenly, her future showed the possibility of something different, and something far more desirable. But Tony had his reputation back on the Daedalus. He was a handsome young man, and was rumored to have had many encounters with young women. She found it hard to believe, in light of all that she had seen of him over the past few months. Such sensitivity could not be faked, she was sure of it. And despite the rumors, she felt compelled to learn more about him. If she had still been on board the Daedalus, she probably wouldn't have given him the time of day. There were several other eligible young men on board, and most of them would make suitable partners for raising a family. But despite her parents' teachings, she had never been comfortable with the idea of leaving such a decision in the hands of others. For as long as she could remember, others had been making decisions about her life for her. Just once, she wanted to make one for herself. And maybe this time, she would. Day 18. Today was a very difficult day, to say the least. It was a day of many firsts for me. It was the first time that I climbed down a mountain, not to mention the first time I fell off of one. Thankfully, nothing was broken, although I am experiencing aches and pains in places that I did not know existed. It was also the first time I went into a pool of water other than the whirlpool at the gym. It was the first time I witnessed an actual volcanic process in action, and it was the first time that my life was threatened by wild animals. Unfortunately, that last one cost us nearly all of our food rations, leaving us no alternative but to live off the land.
lest we face starvation.
Tomorrow will be another first. Jack will be calling upon my scientific expertise in determining what we can safely eat on this planet. I don't have the heart to tell him that my education in biology and nutrition is probably not much better than his own. He seems so confident that I was better qualified to make these assessments. I'll do my best, of course. I suppose I can call upon my training in scientific practices and procedures and develop a method of analyzing the substances in question. The survival encyclopedia we found in the escape pod covers everything you can think of. In fact, we spent much of the evening studying the section on foraging for nourishment in the wild. Determining the immediate toxicity of consumables shouldn't prove too difficult, as the bioscanner is quite adept at such a task. But the myriad of possible side effects is impossible to determine, and the slightest mistake could quite literally prove fatal. But enough dwelling on our misfortunes. On a more positive note, as I mentioned earlier, I have discovered active volcanic activity on this planet. You may wonder why I am excited about this. True, active volcanism can be a significant threat to the colony, but its presence can also be of great value. Geothermal power alone could provide all of the energy we would possibly need without the potential dangers of antimatter reactors. Admittedly, however, no world is without its risks. It is only a question of the benefits outweighing those risks.
Will closed his journal, returning it to the inside of his backpack. He was thankful the animals that absconded with their food hadn't found his journal interesting enough to take. As he climbed into his tent to sleep, he noticed how much more alive the jungle was in comparison to the hills and plains they had traveled through thus far. The still of the night was not an expression one used to describe the jungle, at least not this one. From every direction, he could hear the calls of various creatures as they went about the tasks of life. Squawks and yelps, coos and cries, even the occasional unsettling grunt. It was a symphony of alien life that should have made him nervous, but it did not. Perhaps it was the fatigue of the day's strenuous events, or perhaps it was the knowledge that none of the animals they had encountered thus far had shown any interest in them, only their food. Or perhaps, just maybe, he was finally learning to roll with the punches. Waking later than usual, Will realized that Jack was nowhere to be found. He did find a pot of hash, kept warm by the embers of the fire. His belly rumbling, he held his breath and devoured the foul concoction, avoiding its potent aroma. It was, after all, sustenance. And it might possibly be the last earth food they would ever eat. After breakfast, Will took the pot down to the pond for cleaning, finding Jack sitting on a rock at the water's edge. He was holding a long, crooked stick, obviously cut from a tree branch. Attached to the end of the stick was a thin line that ran down into the water.
"Morning," Jack whispered.
"What are you doing?"
Will whispered back.
"Fishing."
"Fishing?"
"Fishing."
"Why are we whispering?"
"Don't want to scare away the fish."
"Oh, of course."
Will had no idea what Jack was talking about.
"What exactly is fishing?"
"I'm trying to catch a fish," Jack explained. "I read about it in the survival guide. This is a fishing pole," he told him, holding the stick up for him to see.
He was obviously quite proud of his handiwork.
"I see. It's a very nice one, I'm sure."
Will moved over closer to Jack, sitting down on the shore nearby to watch.
"So, how does this thing work?"
"There's a hook on the end of this line here, and on the hook, there's a bug."
A bug? When did you get a bug?"
"They're all over the place, under rocks, under tree roots, anywhere dark and moist."
"Why a bug?"
"To attract the fish."
"Fish like bugs?"
"Earth fish do, at least that's what the book says. Actually, it suggests using worms, but I figured a bug would work."
"Where did you get the hook?"
"I made it out of a needle from the sewing kit. It wasn't easy, either. I broke two of them before I finally got it to work."
So the fish is going to try and eat the bug?
Yes, and when he does, that wad of plastic wrapper from the energy bar will get pulled under the water. That's my signal to yank up on the pole so that the hook digs into its jaw. Then I just pull it up to shore.
I see. Sounds easy enough. How long have you been at it?
About an hour.
Really? How many fish have you caught?
Well, none yet. Nothing has even swum by.
Maybe they don't like bugs.
Maybe, Jack admitted. But if this doesn't work, I'm going to try spearfishing next.
Spearfishing?
Yeah. You get a long straight stick and sharpen one end. Then you wait until a fish swims by and you stab it with the spear.
But I thought you said nothing has swum by yet.
Well, not yet, Jack pondered. But fishing requires patience. Jack sighed. Apparently a lot of it.
I'm going to start looking around for some nuts or berries or something, Will decided.
Are you sure you don't want to try? I can make you a pole if you'd like.
No, thanks. Better we diversify, I expect.
Suit yourself. After cleaning the pot, Will took it with him for a walk around the pond in search of edible plants. The hard thing was deciding what might be edible, and, toxicities aside, what would taste good, as well as provide nourishment. They were difficult questions, ones that he never would have expected to face in his lifetime. Will approached the problem logically. It would be easy enough to choose specimens based on their parallels with edible Terran plants, so looking for things that looked like nuts and berries seemed a good place to start. Within an hour, Will had filled his pot with all manner of specimens. Colorful berries, large and small, brown and tan nuts, and even a few roots and flowers thrown in for variety. With any luck, they might even find something tasty in the bunch. He returned to the campsite, only to find Jack still sitting on his rock, waiting impatiently for a fish to take the bait.
Any luck?
Hell no!
Jack wasn't whispering anymore. Maybe you picked a bad spot. Maybe you should go where the fish already are instead of waiting for them to come to you.
I tried that already. Every time I go to them, they swim away.
Maybe you're supposed to hide or something.
It didn't say anything about hiding in the manual, Jack stated.
Well, maybe these fish are smarter than Earth fish.
Jack hadn't thought of that. It seemed ridiculous, but he wasn't having any luck, and he was willing to give anything a try at this point. He got up and moved behind his rock, crouched down, and held his pole out over the rock. How's this? He asked.
Pretty good, I guess.
Will picked up his pot of plant specimens to head back to camp.
I'm going to go test these samples. Let me know if you catch anything.
Will turned and walked away, trying not to laugh at the sight of his commander squatting down behind a rock, hiding from the smart fish. Jack soon tired of his crouching position, stiff from yesterday's fall. He quickly decided that his position needed to be changed, choosing to sit on the ground behind the rock and lean against it in a semi-reclined position with the pole over his shoulder. He was about to drift off to sleep when he felt a slight tug on the pole. He awoke with a start, unsure of what had caused him to stir. Then there was another tug at the pole, and he turned his head to see the little piece of plastic wrapping he had tied to the line get pulled under the surface.
"Holy crap!"
he exclaimed, as he quickly turned around and rose to his feet, climbing clumsily over the rock to the water's edge. Jack tugged hard at the pole, hoping to lodge the hook deeply into the fish's jaw, just as the manual had instructed.
"Hey, Will! I think I've got something!"
From his testing by the fire pit, Will heard Jack's cries and jumped up to run down to the pond. When he got there, Jack had both hands on the pole and was trying to muscle the fish up onto the shore.
"Unbelievable!" Will exclaimed. "You do have one!"
Will watched as the fish jumped up out of the water. It was long and gray, with a dorsal fin jutting out of its back. Its green and gold stripes on its sides glistened in the midday sun as it fell back into the pond with a splash.
"Man, did you see that? That thing is huge!"
Suddenly, his pole snapped in half,
leaving Jack holding the stump as the other end fell into the water.
And strong, too, Will laughed.
But Jack wasn't giving up that easily, not after over 2 hours of waiting. He ran into the water, splashing madly as he tried to reach the broken tip of the stick, still floating in the water. Just as he was about to grab it, it shot away from him, stomping a meter further out into the pond. Jack dove for the stick, fearing it would get towed farther out, and he might never reach it.
Jack!
Will cried out, fearing that Jack might have fallen into deep water. But Jack was quickly back on his feet, standing waist-deep, the end of the pole firmly in his right hand. He grabbed the end of the line with his left hand, and then his right, as he began backing toward the shore.
Ha! I've got you now!
Jack fought to keep his balance against the pull of the fish that was putting up a valiant struggle to survive. He was amazed at how strong the creature was, as the line dug into his fingers painfully. He quickly wrapped the line around his palm a few times, making sure that it wouldn't slip through his fingers as he continued his way back to shore. Will watched from the shore as the great fish jumped high above the water once again. It had to be at least a meter long. This time, the fish rolled over as it fell back to the water, and Will could see that it had several fins along its sides as well. Jack was back on the shore now, pulling the fish along behind him as it continued to struggle against Jack's hook and line. Then, as suddenly as it started, it stopped. There was silence.
What happened?
Will asked.
I don't know. Is it dead?
Jack quickly pulled it onto shore, wrapping the line around his hand as he brought it in. A minute later, Jack was proudly holding the meter-long fish up high in the air. His blood was surging through his body like he had never felt before. He could feel his heart pounding in his chest, and he was panting with exhilaration.
Would you look at this thing?
Will examined the fish as Jack carried it up to camp. It had three prongs to its tail fin, something that Will was reasonably certain earth fish did not have. Then the fish began flopping on the end of the now short line, startling the both of them. The line broke, and the mighty fish fell to the ground at Jack's feet, thrashing madly as it tried to find a way back to the water. Jack and Will hopped around in a panic, yelling madly as they tried to stop the fish from flopping its way back to the safety of the pond.
"Do something, Jack!"
"Like what?"
he screamed as he pranced.
"Kill the damn thing!"
"How?"
"Hit it! Kick it! Stomp on it! Do something quick, before it gets away!"
They jumped around the struggling fish for a few seconds more, Jack looking about for something to strike it with. Finally, instinct took over, and Jack pulled out his sidearm and quickly fired three rounds at the bouncing creature, sending dirt and fish pieces flying in all directions. The fish stopped its mad dance of survival, thoroughly dead. They stepped up to the dead fish. A greenish fluid oozed out of the end where the fish's head had been. But now, it was only a jagged, fleshy end of the fish's long, meaty torso.
"You blew its head off,"
Will stated in shock.
"Yeah, well, I don't think you're supposed to eat the head anyway,"
Jack said defensively, as he reached down to pick up the carcass. Will stared at the dead fish for a minute. It looked nothing like any of the fish that were raised in the tanks back on the Daedalus for consumption. It didn't even look like anything that he had seen in any of the pictures of fish back on Earth.
"Do you think it's safe to eat?"
Will asked.
"After all that, it better be," Jack exclaimed.
"So, how do you prepare that thing to eat?"
Will asked.
"I still have to read that part,"
Jack admitted, as he carried it back to camp.